This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Taking a look at the issues surrounding the health and well-being of our LGBTIQ+ communities. This is Well, 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 brought to you by the team from Thorn Harbour Health on Joy and the Community Radio Network.
Jack with you here on Well, 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 and I'm now joined in studio by Associate Professor at Monash and Sexual Health Physician, Dr. Jason Ong. First of all, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. I guess tell us a little bit about the work that you do at Monash and at Melbourne Sexual Health Centre.
Thanks, Jack. Really excited to be here. Thanks for the invitation. So I'm a sexual health physician, which means that I'm a clinician that sees people living with HIV and people with STIs comes to our clinic.
Yep.
And as a researcher, I do a lot of work in the HIV space in terms of trying to end HIV transmission in Australia, but also regionally and globally as well.
Cool. I guess, how did you first get interested in sexual health?
Yeah, it seems a long time ago. So it was the early 2000s. I was doing some mission trips into what we call the Golden Triangle. So China, Thailand, and Myanmar, where a lot of the drugs came from.
Yeah.
And I started seeing people with HIV in that area. But it was an odd time because China at that time said that there was no one living with HIV at all in the whole of China. And here in front of me is someone with HIV. But what really struck me was the amount of ignorance around HIV and the stigma. And we went to villages where people would literally be burning people's houses if they learned that someone had HIV.
Right.
Because it was so fearful of the virus, and that just shook me a bit. And
Would have. Yeah. I guess so. That was you said you were doing that sort of in the early noughties?
Early 2000s.
Yeah.
And that was even pre SARS. So I think China kind of learned the lesson from SARS when they said they shouldn't be hiding, but actually tackle the issue. Yeah.
Interesting. I guess that. Interest in sexual health and HIV, my understanding is you have an interest among in those things among more marginalized communities. Mm. I guess tell us more about, I guess, how that influences your work.
Yeah, so definitely reaching out to the marginalized is a big part of the work that I've done. It started in the China experience. And so after that, I came back to Australia. I worked at Parramatta Clinic for a number of years, and then before I moved on to Melbourne Sexual Health Centre. But certainly, I mean, unfortunately, I guess HIV does disproportionately affect those who are kind of kicked out of society's norms. Mm. And that's what really saddened me when I first saw for this area. It really stirred up that fire in me to make a difference and help people. Yeah.
I mean, we've made certainly some impressive strides in addressing HIV in Australia. Some would say, you know, on the leading edge among developed nations, I suppose. But even with that in mind, some communities are still being left behind.
Yeah.
Why do you feel that's the case?
Yeah, absolutely. So as impressive as our response has been, as you say, people like those who are overseas born, particularly those recently arrived, even some heterosexual groups as well, and our First Nations people are being left behind. And I think it's because of multiple barriers to testing, as well as accessing the life-saving treatments that we have. And there's a whole bunch of things that are particularly more prevalent in these left behind groups. So one is the amount of stigma that's still around HIV and also same-sex behaviors, if they're coming from more conservative backgrounds, unequal access to effective prevention methods like PrEP. So we know that overseas born people without Medicare access, they find it harder to access PrEP. We unfortunately still have quite restrictive migration laws for people with HIV in Australia. And in some ways, we are kind of behind the rest of the world. So as good as Australia's response is, we're actually behind in terms of looking at our HIV migration laws. We've also seen in my research lack of knowledge about, you know, people navigating our health system. And HIV is not a priority for those who are coming recently arrived. They need to look after themselves in terms of finding a job, education, and so on. So health is kind of down the list for them. And quite shockingly, actually, a couple of years ago, we did a big survey amongst gay Asian men, and 91% of those, about 1,000 men were surveyed, said there was race-based discrimination as well. And that was mainly sexual racism. So kind of feeling a bit othered even when they're here in Australia. And that all kind of feeds into the fact that they don't access treatment or even testing. And one last thing I would add is, especially for the overseas born, there are fears that testing positive would mean that it would impact their visas, and also governments or employers will somehow find out about their status. So all of this kind of feeds into this amorphous risk factors, I guess, that means that they're being left behind.
I guess there are two things that I kind of want to pull out there. Mm. You spoke a bit about migration laws being not what I imagine is not quite as progressive in Australia compared to other nations for people living with HIV.
Yeah.
What does that look like for people that don't know how being like living with HIV might affect migrating to Australia? What does that look like?
Yeah, so absolutely. So currently, if you want to apply for a permanent residency in Australia, you have to do HIV tests. And if you do have HIV, you automatically fail. So your visa is rejected.
Right.
And you need to apply for a health waiver to basically justify your value to society and why you shouldn't cost the Australians this amount of money. So that law is we think it's quite, it needs to be changed. Mm. The rest of the world have changed. I think Australia is one of probably only 40 countries left in the world that has such laws. We have tried to speak to the government, and they are also looking into this matter. So they do recognize this is an issue. And you can imagine that kind of fear that puts onto people who are here in Australia who are overseas born.
Yeah.
That, so they'll say, I'm not going to get tested then. I'm not going to find out.
Yeah.
So I think getting rid of that would help us to be giving the messaging out to people that it is safe to test and we will look after you. Because another great thing that the Australian government has done recently since last year is to make HIV medications completely free, regardless of your Medicare status.
Mm.
So you don't need Medicare to access free treatments. So, yeah.
When, if you can speak to this, when do you feel Australia in that context was sort of left behind by, I imagine, a number of other nations changing their migration laws?
Mm.
When did that shift broadly sort of happen in other countries where it was easy for people living with HIV to migrate?
Yeah, I mean, our closest neighbor, New Zealand, changed their laws must be 2 or 3 years ago. So it was quite recent. But they also recognize the fact that these kind of laws are not helpful and kind of labeling people as, you know, threats to society and costing society so we too much, and so we don't want you in our country. That kind of message, I know it's not the intention of these laws, but it's the implications
that barrier to testing, obviously, for overseas born folk, that is a huge problem.
Yep.
The other community you spoke about, I guess, in your answer earlier was increasingly heterosexual people, I guess, or in some cases, straight identifying men who have sex with men may well be the case.
Exactly.
What are some of the barriers there? Is that largely related to stigma?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think in Australia, if you speak to any Joe Blogs on the street, they still see HIV as a gay man's disease.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of pervading impression. And so being a heterosexual to even come to even Melbourne Sexual Health Centre, sometimes they do feel a bit uncomfortable saying that, oh, I'm coming into here and people might think I'm gay when I'm sitting in the waiting area and so on. And as our epidemic changes, I mean, the great news, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is for Australian-born gay bisexual men, the rates are dropping. And because of that, actually, if we look at the proportion of new infections each year, increasingly the heterosexuals are getting higher and higher.
Yeah.
So probably it's close to 30-40% now of our new infections are amongst heterosexuals.
Yep. Goodness, I didn't know that it was quite that high.
Yeah.
You know, kind of shift gears a little bit.
Yeah.
Earlier this year during IAS 2023, we saw a news story that Inner Sydney was celebrating virtual elimination of HIV. As exciting as that is in some ways, how do you feel about that when we think about marginalized communities and perhaps our region more broadly outside of Sydney?
Yeah, I was really excited when they announced that. It's really fantastic to see that it's actually possible to beat the virus. So we, with the tools that we have, we can actually get there. But your question is, you know, even though we have these tools, we're not utilizing them equally. And therefore, just trying to understand the people that we're leaving behind. And I've come up with actually a bit of a formula that if we can implement this for all populations, then I think we can beat the virus. So it's a little maths formula. So it's science plus strong partnerships. And then you can put brackets to the power of living in a society with less stigma. So science in the sense that we've got all the tools that we've got great medications. If you are infected, we can put you on medications that will prolong your life, keep you healthy. We've got PrEP, which is will prevent you up to 99% effective at preventing HIV. So we've got all of that. And then the partnerships, which Australia does really well with clinicians, researchers, community, government, and that's a strength of our response. So putting those two together, but then putting the brackets around the society with less stigma, the laws which we talked about and so on to encourage people to be tested and treated. I think if we can do that for all populations, not just the people that are being left behind in Australia, but we also know in our region, in Asia Pacific region, we've got some of the fastest growing epidemics of HIV around the world. So in the Philippines, for example, Indonesia, and they unfortunately lack this, if you want to use my formula, they're not doing this formula, which we have implemented in Sydney, which shows that it works.
I guess this kind of goes to your response there. You've been described as a clinician, epidemiologist, and a health economist.
Yes.
Could you explain for listeners what a health economist is?
Yeah, it's a daunting term, I guess. I mean, basically, it's someone who tries to produce some evidence to inform better decision making. And specifically, the role that I do is to understand value for money. So my job is to build models to kind of predict costs and benefits of implementing kind of new programs or kind of new drugs.
Cool. As part of, you know, your the areas that you work in, I suppose, you've been involved in a number of projects around sexual health, HIV prevention, and even COVID-19. I guess, can you speak a little bit to the impact COVID-19 had on our ongoing response to HIV?
Yeah, so I guess specifically Melbourne, I think we're probably one of the most locked down cities around the world.
Yeah, I think we were the most, cumulatively.
Yeah, so that definitely impacted people. Ability to test for HIV and STIs. And actually, we were initially quite fearful because we saw the drop in testing that there might be a rebound effect of, you know, missed infections or having a later diagnosis. Thankfully, in the latest data that we've seen from the Kirby, we haven't seen this as yet. And in fact, the opposite in a sense that, you know, the total amount of HIV was actually dropping, which is actually good. So I think we missed a bullet there. But yeah, I think COVID definitely had made people kind of test less. But there was actually a positive effect from this, and that was the fact that people were getting comfortable with the idea of self-testing. And that opens up a whole new way of getting people tested, because as you know, we actually now have a self-testing kit available from online, from pharmacies, even from vending machines.
Yes.
And there's actually a great initiative, which I'll talk about. If people go to hivtest.au, this is something that NAPWHA, which is the National Association of People with HIV and Queensland Positive People, together with funding from Gilead, actually now gives people these kits completely free. So people can go onto the website, get this done. And yeah, so that was a positive spin-off from COVID, that people felt that, you know, I'm pretty comfortable with doing a test myself and trying to read the results. So I think that's a good message to try to get out.
This, I guess, answer this to the best you can, because it's a little bit maybe still figuring out kind of what I'm asking here. But
yeah,
I feel like, especially in Melbourne, we saw a lot of attention around the COVID-19 numbers, how to try and reduce risk. Do you feel like people's increased health literacy through, obviously Melbourne was hit the hardest and maybe people were the most tuned into that here in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Do you think that increased health literacy also plays a part in reducing HIV notifications?
Yeah, I hope that people recognizing, you know, the impacts of infectious diseases and the fact that they can test and protect themselves and people in the community, that kind of concept, hopefully that will help people realize the importance of trying to work together. It's something that we can't just, like, we have to allow every single person to be a part of the response. And I think one of the good things about COVID was, regardless of Medicare status or not, people could be tested for COVID, people could access treatments and so on. So in the same way, that kind of mentality should come into our HIV response where, you know, we can't just be focused on, oh, all the Medicare people will kind of look after, but everyone else we ignore. But we can't ignore them because they could then affect the rest of the population. So infectious diseases has no, it doesn't discriminate. kind of affects everyone. And in that sense, we have to pull everyone together and kind of work together.
You spoke about that. HIV test, it was hivtest.au was the website.
Yep.
So that program was put together, you said, by NAPWHA and by QPP.
Yep.
The Atomo tests at Thorn Harbour and at SAMESH in Adelaide, we've worked on a project, Connect, which through vending machines, as you mentioned, helps vend those. And you're talking about, I guess, making sure that we bring the entire community along with us in terms of fighting HIV.
Yep.
I guess we think a lot at Thorn Harbour and at SAMESH, especially on the Connect project, about trying to reach overseas-born, in particular men who have sex with men, but also the heterosexual community. In our experience, well, in my experience, I can't speak for everyone else on the team, it's something that we worry about being able to reach those people, because I think as far as, say, AIDS councils have experienced, the community is connected to these organizations, and we know how to reach them through community events, through public health messaging. Is it, I guess, as much a problem of the Australian government or particular health bodies not being not wanting or not knowing that it's important to reach heterosexual overseas-born communities, or is it more a problem of we don't know how to best connect with these communities?
Yeah, I think it's the latter.
Yeah.
So it's about trying to involve them, actively involving them in all our designs. I mean, we've been hugely successful in reaching the Australian-born white gay men. And the fact that, I mean, these people are being left behind, it's maybe we're not talking to them enough and co-designing interventions that are culturally appropriate and creating spaces for them to feel that, yes, I can kind of disclose and talk to people. It's hugely expensive because in some sense, reaching the unreached, I don't really like that term, but people that we're underserving perhaps.
Yes.
It means that we have to make a lot of effort to go to them. And it takes many years for that community to trust us. And I'm speaking specifically my work amongst the Asian-born gay bisexual men where, it took years to just get that reputation in that community that, you know, it's safe to engage with us.
Yeah.
And now we kind of enjoy that in the sense that they are now part of a lot of my projects where, you know, from the start to the end, they're talking to me about, you know, this is what the community needs. These are the things that we think are more culturally appropriate. So it's not about just translating English resources, which we've used, into a different language, but it's kind of packaging that properly so that it speaks to the culture in a safe and kind of relevant way.
Are there examples of that being well done, whether it's in Australia or abroad?
So we're in the midst of doing something. Last year, we did something called crowdsourcing, which is where we, instead of a top-down approach to designing a campaign, we actually went to the community and asked them, you know, give us all your ideas about how should we better reach Asian-born people for awareness of PrEP. And so they gave us lots of ideas. And then earlier this year at the Alfred Health as well, we've kind of brought the community together in what we call the Designathon. So this is where we have teams of people kind of competing against each other for the best ideas. And the winning idea was it was an audio drama. So some kind of podcast where it, in a fun and again, culturally appropriate way, we spoke to the community about PrEP, you know, the fears about PrEP, you know, it could be, you know, their fears about, you know, Chinese medicines, kind of interacting with PrEP. And we spoke a bit about, you know, stigma and discrimination that Asian community might feel and how does that all interact. So we kind of, rather than a one pager that we hand out about PrEP, we kind of package it all in a in an audio drama, again, kind of voiced by people from the community and so on. So we're working, that's an example where we spent a lot of time, like it took us 2 years to get to this spot, to really co-design something from the bottom up.
If we're talking about resources that are more time intensive and therefore more expensive, do you feel like that is a reality that public health units and government, which largely fund a lot of the community work and a lot of the public health messaging, do you feel like that is that financial reality is an issue that those bodies are aware of, or is it something that they still need to kind of realize?
I think they need to realize it. I think in some ways, as we become more successful in our HIV response and as less and less people become infected each year, actually, there's a danger for us where funders will say, oh, it's not a problem anymore. And so you'll get less and less funding. But the problem is, as we've seen from many other infectious diseases, actually to try to get to those final 5% or so,
that's
takes
really
a lot. Exactly. Yeah. And that's where actually you need to intensify your resources to try to reach that. Otherwise, we'll go backwards again.
And I certainly don't want to, like, you know, bag out government organizations or anything. No. I mean, the reality is, like, I imagine initiatives like HIVtest.au and, like, funded through AIDS councils around the country, like Connect was, you know, a similar situation where we're seeing support for initiatives like this from state government bodies, from federal government, but I guess more the point is it's still not enough, and it will increasingly not be enough to reach those final, you know, the few people, the decreasing number of HIV notifications we see.
Yeah, exactly. I would actually give kudos to the current government where they've actually set up, so Minister Butler has actually set up an HIV task force, which is impressive. I mean, when they first announced that, it's like, wow, the government is really interested in hearing. And they'll be launching something at World AIDS Day as well. So it's great that government is actually wanting to do something about it. So I think they do recognize the issue. I guess we'll need to see what happens after the announcements. I mean, as in all kind of political statements, is that, you know, does the resources then flow on to their commitments? But at least that's the first step. I think political will is always very important.
Yeah. I mean, when you see an announcement, it's, I think, maybe exciting for some people to see, oh, you know, there's this initiative, there's this effort behind it. But in the case of, you mentioned Minister Butler there, earlier this year, I believe he came out speaking about reducing vaping access, in particular for children. And we've heard more recently that there is a lot of work that goes into working across state and territory bodies to try and make sure that, you know, these initiatives actually make sense and work in the way that we want them to. I guess you spoke a little bit about that audio drama, which I love. Like, it just seems quite fun to me. Are there any other pieces of work that you're particularly proud of to have worked on so far?
There were two pieces actually this year. So the first one was earlier this year, I was working with the World Health Organization to try to improve testing. And we were thinking about a global policy on social network approaches. And what that means is that, for example, if we gave you a HIV self-testing kit, we will give you an extra 3 or 5 kits to pass on to your friends, your colleagues, or other people in the social networks. And we generated enough evidence for WHO to actually make a new recommendation at the International AIDS Society conference this year to say that, you know, this approach is recommended for all populations as a means to improve testing. So I was really excited about that piece of work. And it's something that we can do better, I think, as we now have access to the kits. The second piece of work I'm really proud of for my team is that we surveyed over 22,000 gay bisexual men and over 1,500 transgender women within the Asia Pacific region, so 16 countries in total. And we were looking at their preferences for how to access PrEP. So basically trying to accelerate the delivery of PrEP in this region.
Which I guess the context is that it varies wildly from region, from country to country.
Correct. Yeah. So we were able to then kind of give tailored information to every country to say, these are what your populations want. But it was interesting, as we looked at the data, actually a consistent message came out. So it was around peer-led community clinics was highly valued. And they also highly valued STI testing and also decreasing the frequency of needing to go for PrEP, because currently it's every 3 months.
Yeah.
But people wanted, you know, 6-12 monthly like physical visits, but maybe in between they can do self-testing or something else. So that piece is being written up at the moment. So it should be published hopefully in the next few months. We were really excited about that because number one, it's probably the largest survey within these kind of marginalized populations, especially in countries where it was really difficult to get people. But we were pleased that we got the numbers. Yeah.
Did you see, you said that part of that work is yet to be published,
yep.
But if you've spoken to any public health organizations or government organizations,
yep.
Have you seen much reception to and much of a response to what you brought to them? Or is it a little bit too early to ask?
Yeah, it's slightly early, but we started to publicize some of our findings.
Yep.
And so we did this in collaboration with the World Health Organization and also with UNAIDS as well.
Mm.
So our purpose is to not just let this sit in a shelf somewhere, but action it. I think then the WHO will take this to their country directors and regions and actually start the dialogue amongst their policymakers and funders. And the University of New South Wales, the Kirby Institute, we've actually published just a report to summarize it. So it's not the academic presentation,
yep.
But actually the report with all the information is already out in public so that people can already read about it.
Is there any emerging tech on the horizon we should be aware of or that listeners might be interested in when it comes to HIV prevention and sexual health more broadly? I mean, we spoke a little bit about HIV self-testing.
Yep.
That has been around in one capacity or another for, I think it's fair to say, a few years now.
Yep.
The access has been a little bit wobbly. I think early on in trying to communicate, I think we spoke with Atomo's CEO about how the TGA's guidance around advertising or promoting the use of those kits was a little bit rough at the beginning. That's increased, but I guess beyond HIV self-testing, what else, what emerging tech do you anticipate or do you think people would be keen to see?
There's three things I came up with. So the first one is injectable PrEP. So that's actually now subsidized in Australia, which is really exciting. But how we are actually going to roll it out is going to be the next issue, I guess, but at least it's now on the cards. So people who find oral PrEPs not suitable for them or contraindicated, we can actually give them injectable PrEP, which is one exciting technology. The second one is something to watch, I think, still in the research phase, but a drug called lenacapavir, which is a subcutaneous injection, which potentially could be used as PrEP as well. And it's a 6-monthly kind of subcutaneous, potentially, hopefully self-injected PrEP.
I was going to say subcutaneous for people who might not know is sort of where you would imagine like a COVID vaccine going.
Yeah, in? Yeah, okay, cool. Exactly. Yeah. So, which is exciting because then you don't have to turn up to a doctor to do this. You could just do it at home. And it's just once every 6 months and you're protected against HIV, which is, I think that will be a game changer. That's, as I said, it's a little fair ways away because we're still doing some research to make sure it's safe and effective. And the third kind of technology, if I can kind of label it as that, I guess it's not new, but DoxyPep is something that people talk about.
Yeah.
So taking 200 milligrams of doxycycline within 72 hours of a risky or condomless sex.
Yeah.
Actually reduces syphilis and chlamydia and maybe gonorrhea. There's a question mark around that.
Yeah.
ASHRM has produced some guidance around this, but it's still, it's in a space where we're still trying to work out, you know, how best to implement this, how do we recommend this properly, because there are downsides to taking too much antibiotics as well.
Yes. Well, I mean, certainly within the context of Australia, where we have some of the highest rates of skin cancer, I think that was part of why, at least within Thorn Harbor, when we were having conversations around what Doxy PrEP might look like, that might not make so much sense here. Doxy PEP, potentially, but again, it kind of depends on the circumstances. I kind of want to quickly go back to, you spoke about the subcutaneous or long-acting injectable PrEP. Yep. And when you spoke with survey participants from that sort of wider region survey, you heard from people that they were keen to see 6 to 12 month PrEP prescriptions, I guess.
Yep.
Does that exist in Australia currently?
No. Okay. It's the short answer. We're trying to move towards that. So we're trying to relax, I guess, regulations around how much we can give in terms of at the prescription. But I think the reality is, from what I can tell from our clients, because a lot of them are moving to on-demand PrEP.
Yeah.
So actually their script lasts more than 3 months anyway. So
they
don't have to come back every 3 months, although that's the current recommendation. But it's difficult because at the same time, I mean, we want them to be tested for HIV every 3 months, but we also know, because how effective PrEP is anyway, so maybe there's less urgency for that 3 month test. And then maybe they could do the self-testing themselves in the interim and then pop in to see us every 6 months. But what I'm saying is quite controversial. It's not in our guidelines, but we are definitely thinking about, you know, how can we decentralize it, make it less medicalized, so that people who need it can just easily access it. Even from, we've been having discussions around, you know, why don't people turn up to pharmacy and, you know, bypass the doctor, and as they access contraception or emergency contraception, they can do the same for PrEP. I mean, again, it's early days, but these are the types of things we're trying to think about to make PrEP a bit more accessible.
We've spoken about a lot of challenges that we are yet to overcome in response to HIV in Australia. Yeah. I guess to close out, are there any other challenges that we haven't spoken about, that we haven't sort of hit head on in our response to HIV in Australia?
I think we covered a lot of ground. I think,
it's true.
Yeah, I think I'll definitely stress that formula that I gave, the science plus partnerships brackets less stigma. And thinking, using that framework and trying to apply that across all populations would be good. And I'll also stress the fact that we want to actively engage the people that were kind of being left behind as part, not just participants, but collaborators, and actively design things together with them would be fantastic to see more of. Yep.
Associate Professor at Monash and Sexual Health Physician at Melbourne Sexual Health Centre, Dr. Jason Ong, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks, Jack.
Thanks for listening to Well, 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 supported by Thorn Harbour Health on Joy and the Community Radio Network. For more LGBTIQ plus health and wellbeing and much more, check out Thorn Harbour on social media at Thorn Harbour or via the website thornharbour.org.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.